This is Wisconsin Today. It's the 50th anniversary of the Safe Drinking Water Act, signed into law in 1974. It set federal drinking water standards for the country.
Recently, Wisconsin has seen some new funding to improve water infrastructure and drinking water safety, but some advocacy groups say more is needed to support vulnerable communities dealing with contamination of their water supply by lead, nitrates, or PFAS chemicals.
Earlier this month, leaders from more than 30 organizations signed an open letter to the state legislature asking for a major investment in water infrastructure. Peter Burris is government affairs manager for Wisconsin Conservation Voters, one of the groups that were part of that open letter. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we dig into what you're looking for in Wisconsin right now, the Safe Drinking Water Act, 50th anniversary today, what kind of changes did it make possible?
Yeah, so December 16th, 1974, 50th anniversary is a great opportunity to look at the progress we've made and talk about what we still need to do. So appreciate you having me on. The law is really known for establishing our national drinking water standards. So today here in the United States, we have public health-based standards for more than 90 contaminants. So think scary contaminants like arsenic, mercury, E. coli. And then in a 1996 amendment to the bill, the Safe Drinking Water Loan Program was created, through which states get funding out to impacted communities for their water infrastructure. And yet the act provides no protections for our groundwater. Two-thirds of Wisconsinites rely on our groundwater as their source for drinking water. A third of Wisconsinites rely on private wells for their groundwater for their private wells as their source for drinking water. So we need to take action there. And also we just need more grant funding into this program. You know, given levy limits and municipal debt limit constraints, we see lots of rate hikes across the state and the burden of infrastructure upgrades at the local level, when at the same time the state is sitting on a $1 billion surplus that we could be using to address some of these problems.
And to that point, you recently joined that open letter signed by more than 30 groups calling on the state legislature to take action on some of what you were just talking about, putting money into safe drinking water. What are the big changes? What are the big investments you and your colleagues are hoping to see?
Yeah, well, if I could first, kind of a little lay of the land in terms of the problems we're still seeing. Mm-hmm. So across the state, we know that 91 public water systems exceed the federal standards for PFAS, which are tied to increased cholesterol levels, thyroid disease, certain cancers, and pregnancy complications. We know that there are around at least 150,000 lead service lines scattered across more than 70 Wisconsin communities, tied to hearing loss, lower IQs, developmental delays, behavioral challenges, emotional impacts like anxiety and depression. And we know there are an estimated 42,000 private wells that exceed the nitrate standard, which is nitrates tied to health effects, including cancer, birth defects, and even infant death. And so we know that around the state, there are too many communities who are brushing their teeth, washing their dishes, mixing their baby formula, and preparing their meals with these 5-gallon water jugs of drinking water because they can't trust the water that's coming out of their tap. So meanwhile, we are sitting on a $4 billion surplus, and we need these investments in our public water infrastructure, support for private well owners, and preventative action. And so that's why we, in partnership with 30 different organizations, a combination of local leaders from impacted communities, faith-based leaders, hunters and anglers, health experts, environmental policy experts, and legal experts, all came together on this letter to the legislature asking them to invest $953 million into our public water infrastructure, to take concrete steps to support private well owners, and to support policy on preventative action.
I want to jump into that preventative action. Obviously, we want to remediate lead lines where they are. What kind of things could we do to keep things like nitrate contamination and then future PFAS chemical pollution in groundwater and well water?
Yeah, well, on nitrate, we know that programs that pay farmers based on how well they're getting nitrate, keeping nitrate out of our groundwater, that we should be looking more at those pay-for-performance-based programs. On PFAS, we should be looking at what other states are doing. Minnesota has already passed a phase out of PFAS in non-essential consumer products. And so they're leading the way and reaping the economic benefits of leading the way. So we should be doing the same thing. And on lead, we know that we need to support lead investigations in our properties. We have folks moving into rental properties, and they don't know if those properties are safe to live within. So we should be placing an expectation on folks or allowing local communities to require those local inspections. And we know that all of this has a huge economic benefit. We cited research in our letter that the state could save up to $2 billion annually across these three different contaminants by taking substantive action.
Where do those savings come from?
They come from the savings associated with some of the different health impacts. So think about PFAS and the health impacts associated with hyperthyroidism, low birth weights. Think about lead and the health, the impacts associated with cardiovascular disease, IQ loss, short-term damage to cognitive function. Think about nitrate and the health impacts associated with colon, ovarian, thyroid, bladder, and kidney cancer. When we prevent those health impacts, we save our families, our state, a lot of money.
In our last few moments, have you gotten much response from this letter yet from state lawmakers as they get ready for next year's session?
Some response, yeah. And I think, you know, one thing that we're really trying to get at with this letter is that over the past 14 years, our legislature has really operated with this scarcity mindset where impacted communities have been pitted against each other for limited funding. You know, I've heard action on lead is fine, but my constituents are dealing with PFAS, or action on PFAS is fine, but my constituents are dealing with nitrate. And that doesn't work for people who can't drink their water, and it doesn't need to be the way that things are. We know that access to safe drinking water should not be your zero-sum competition, and we have the resources to address these issues. But we really need folks to engage. You know, we have fair maps now. We've got a purple legislature. We've got about a fourth of the legislature new to the building. And so this session is a particularly good opportunity to build bipartisan relationships and deliver for Wisconsin communities. But we're counting on folks across the state to help make that happen. So.
And we'll leave it there. That's Peter Burris with Wisconsin Conservation Voters talking about drinking water infrastructure, pollution, and safety here in Wisconsin.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, Milwaukee County emergency responders can now start life-saving blood transfusions for critically injured patients on the scene.
You can actually get it well before you even arrive at the hospital and start to be stabilized in the field.
An ER doctor on a new initiative to help save trauma patients. That's next on WPR News. Milwaukee County Emergency Medical Services is now giving blood transfusions to critically ill trauma patients before they reach the hospital. And city leaders say it's the first 911 system in Wisconsin to offer this type of care in the field.
Milwaukee County EMS used a whole blood transfusion for the first time last month when responders from the Wauwatosa Fire Department treated a patient suffering from multiple gunshot wounds, and that patient survived.
Dr. Ben Weston is the Milwaukee County Chief Health Policy Advisor and EMS Medical Director. He's also an associate professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Weston, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Can you break down what a pre-hospital blood transfusion is and what happens in this procedure?
Absolutely. Well, maybe we can start with just the word pre-hospital. It's something that a lot of folks aren't necessarily aware of. And so what we're talking about is bringing blood to the patient where they are. And so when somebody has a traumatic injury, whether that's a gunshot, a motor vehicle crash, a fall, a lot of times they have bleeding. And that is one of the things that can lead to really poor outcomes in traumatic injury is that bleeding. It could be external bleeding or it can be internal bleeding. But what that person needs, and what evidence continues to tell us again and again, is that that person really needs blood, which makes sense. And so what we are doing in Milwaukee County is bringing that blood to the patient. And so rather than waiting to have to get to the hospital and arrive and get the blood, you can actually get it well before you even arrive at the hospital and start to be stabilized in the field.
And that transfusion will start either in the field or inside the ambulance?
That's exactly right. Yeah, what we don't want to do is delay the patient's arrival At the hospital. And so we'll do blood in tandem with everything we're doing, with getting the patient packaged up, getting them in the back of the ambulance and transporting them. As we're doing all that, we can start blood and get that transfusion going and help to stabilize that patient.
You mentioned gun violence. What kinds of injuries or incidents might involve significant blood loss?
I mean, really, the sky's the limit. Anything you can think of that somebody could be traumatically injured with. And so, of course, in our community, a lot of this is motor vehicle crashes. That's probably in any community throughout Wisconsin. We also, unfortunately, see a fair amount of firearm violence. Any sort of bleeding, as long as it becomes major bleeding and you're actually dropping your blood pressure, that's when it gets really quite dangerous. And time is really of the essence. In those cases, we find that there's a 2% increase in mortality and death for every 1 minute delay in receiving blood. And so the faster we can get blood to that patient, the better they're going to do. And this is a situation where really minutes count.
How has Milwaukee County been able to overcome the barriers that have stopped other EMS systems from providing this intervention?
The way we've done this is through a lot of work. And certainly team effort. So it's been the better part of a year that we've been working to get this program together. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, putting together quality improvement metrics. Every initiative we do, we bundle with quality improvement metrics to say, is it working? Is it effective? Are we doing a good job? Where can we do better? And then getting education in place. And so we have our educators traveling out to all those different fire departments to do hands-on training and show our providers, how do you use these specialized coolers? This is not the kind of cooler that you bring your lunch to work in. This is a cooler connected to Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and cellular, and it keeps it within a very tight temperature control to make sure that blood is ready to use and can stay there for days on end when not being used. And so there's a lot of equipment involved. There's a lot of knowledge involved. But our fire departments were very eager to do this. Our blood bank and our hospital partners were very engaged. And so we're excited to introduce it. And I think it goes along with a long history of this sort of innovation in Milwaukee County.
You're tracking it closely, I'd imagine. In your estimation, how many lives could this save in Milwaukee County being able to offer whole blood transfusions?
Yeah, so when we look at traumatic injuries in Milwaukee County over a year, it's well over 100 cases of individuals that have this sort of severe low blood pressure in the setting of trauma that could be helped by this. And we were excited to see right when we introduced the program, we actually had our first save. It was a young man who had multiple gunshot wounds, and his blood pressure was very low in the field, so low that it can easily lead to cardiac arrest and that patient not even making it to the hospital. But they started blood on him right away. This was the Wauwatosa Fire Department, one of our 14 fire departments. They started blood on him right away. They brought his pressure up. They stabilized him. They got him to the hospital. He was able to get emergency surgery and is recovering. And so we were excited for that to be our first case. It's incredibly great for that patient, great for the community, but also great for our departments to see this program in action, to see that it really saved a life.
We're talking with Dr. Ben Weston, Milwaukee County Chief Health Policy Advisor and EMS Medical Director, looking at a new initiative by Milwaukee County EMS to offer whole blood transfusions in the field for critically injured trauma patients. Dr. Weston, why whole blood versus components?
That's a great question. So the data shows that that's what works best. That's the short answer. But the longer answer is you can give components. So in fact, there are times when the whole blood supply is limited. Whole blood's a little harder to come by. And for folks listening, whole blood is just what it sounds like. It's whole blood. It's every component altogether. It's what comes out of your body, basically, is what we put back in. Now, components are helpful, whether it's packed red blood cells, the cells that carry oxygen to different parts of our body, or plasma or platelets, all these different components of blood can be helpful to give. They're a little easier to come by. But the data shows that whole blood is best. Giving somebody who is losing whole blood more whole blood is really what they need. And they need that instead of fluids. So traditionally, what we have done, what EMS systems all over the country have done, is when somebody is in shock, when their blood pressure is dropping from a traumatic injury, they'll give them fluids, saline, which is basically salt water. Now, that does have some benefits. It helps to plump up the vessels. It helps to get the blood pressure up a bit and get some circulation going. But the problem, of course, is it doesn't do what blood does, which is not just that volume effect, but also getting all those essential components, getting those red blood cells in there to bring oxygen to where it needs to go to keep the brain functioning, keep the heart functioning, keep all the organs functioning. And then platelets to help clot the blood, all these different clotting factors to help the blood clot, which is, of course, essential when you're bleeding, is to slow that bleeding. And so study after study after study shows that whole blood is really the way to go.
In terms of the cost of rolling this out there, you mentioned the training, the storage, the equipment. What is the impact of the cost versus the benefits in terms of being able to offer this pre-hospital?
Yeah, it's an important thing to look at. So there are upfront costs with this, and that's where a lot of the cost really comes from. I mentioned the equipment, I mentioned the training, I mentioned the education. All of that has a cost associated with it. But thankfully, it's a one-time cost for most of those sort of things. Of course, we want to do some continuing education and keep an eye on those quality benchmarks. But for example, those coolers are a one-time cost. You buy them, you install them, and then you have them. The recurring cost is the actual blood itself. That, of course, doesn't come for free. So a bag, a unit of whole blood is about $700 is what the blood bank will charge for that. And for a patient who's in a traumatic injury and requiring blood because they're that sick, you know, we can talk more about the state of our healthcare system, but $700 is not a major impact there. And if that $700 is what's saving the patient's life, as was likely the case with this individual I told you about who received blood, that's a pretty good investment.
In terms of blood shortages, there is an ongoing blood shortage. Does that pose any type of challenge if you don't have a consistent blood supply, whole blood supply?
So a consistent blood supply is essential for this program to work, of course. You need to have blood in the ambulance if you're able to give it. Now, on one hand, if we were to not have blood available, we could go back to what we used to do. That is always an option, and our paramedics know that. But we hope to maintain a blood supply. The thing that's interesting about giving blood in the pre-hospital period, as opposed to waiting till the patient gets to the hospital, is that when you look over a large number of patients, it actually saves the amount of blood. You have to use less blood. Now, that makes sense because you're giving the blood to the patient when they're less sick. So you're giving the blood to the patient, say, 10, 15, 20 minutes prior to when they otherwise would have received that blood upon arrival to the emergency department. And so by the time they arrive to the emergency department, they're a lot sicker. That bleeding may be continuing because they don't have that those clotting factors on board. And so they need more blood. If you give it to them in that pre-hospital space, you actually save it. The data shows about 7% less blood is used when you give it earlier on because you can stabilize that patient, you can help to slow down that bleeding, and you can get them in a much better place when they arrive at the hospital. So even though in the short term we have to get more blood out in the field, in the long term we're actually going to use less blood with a program like this than we would without a program like this.
Dr. Weston, have you heard of other communities that may follow suit, follow in this path of Milwaukee County?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've had outreach from a number of different communities throughout Wisconsin asking how exactly we did this. It's similar to about a year and a half ago when we introduced buprenorphine in the field. Now, buprenorphine, it's a whole different topic, but that's medication-assisted treatment for folks with opioid use disorder. Similar to methadone, but a different medication. When we did that, we were the first in Wisconsin to do that. And we received a lot of outreach from other communities who wanted to do it as well, because we're not the only ones with a substance use disorder issue in our community. And one of the great things about Milwaukee County is we have the support from the county executive all the way down to not just improve our community, but try to really step out there and improve the health of the rest of the state. And so we will share anything. We'll share the conversations we've had, the contracts we've had. You can copy and paste our guidelines for all we care and take them and use them in the community, especially smaller communities that may not have quite the resources and the personnel that Milwaukee County does to develop all this. We're happy for them to duplicate what we're doing to help the folks in their community as well.
Dr. Weston, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Ben Weston, the Milwaukee County Chief Health Policy Advisor and EMS Medical Director and an Associate Professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We've been talking about a new initiative by Milwaukee County EMS to provide blood transfusions to critically injured trauma patients before they reach the hospital. And for disclosure, Medical College of Wisconsin is a business sponsor of WPR.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, a caroling troupe crisscrosses the state, dressed up in the style of the Charles Dickens era and in harmony on holiday favorites.
There is a nostalgia or a sort of a time bygone that can exist when we're in the costumes. And I think that's part of the fun and the appeal of the Dickensian caroling.
Meet the Wisconsin Dickens carolers on WPR News.
Dashing through the snow in a one-horse open sleigh, o'er the fields we go, laughing all the way.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret. Making spirits
bright. And I'm Kate Archer Kent. That's Jingle Bells, performed by the Wisconsin Dickens Carolers. They are a group of classically trained musicians who perform holiday songs across the state.
Dressed in Victorian era themed costumes, the caroling troupe sings at parades, tree lighting ceremonies, and they made visits to nursing homes, bringing the season of good cheer to residents.
Kirsten Robley is a member and artistic coordinator of the Wisconsin Dickens Carolers. Kirsten, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is great.
You just performed at an assisted living facility in the Milwaukee area. How did the residents respond to the carols?
They were wonderful. We usually do a couple of assisted care living, memory care visits each holiday season. And they're often some of our most special visits because we get people who don't always have family who are able to visit or have friends close by anymore. So it tends to be a really special moment for them to have people visiting, have people singing along. And a lot of them often join us in the caroling as well, which we always find to be so joyful.
I bet it really helps to bring up memories, and it can be probably emotional and moving, these experiences.
Oh, definitely. We see people getting, you know, we see people smiling. We see people occasionally getting a little teary. We see people, you know, sitting there and maybe they seemed a little bit like they weren't paying attention. All of a sudden, the right carol hits them and they are singing along, or they're nodding, or they close their eyes and they're just listening. And it becomes really special. You really see that evolution. We see that a lot in carols. I find most frequently I see it in Silent Night. There's something about Silent Night specifically that really pulls on people's heartstrings in a way that I think some carols don't always do in that way.
The peace and the calm. And I'm wondering, you know, you're a professional musician. You've taught singing lessons. And you find that there is this added layer of appreciation for audiences when they hear these carols. Why do you think that is?
I think it pulls back to something that they remember from their childhood. I mean, there are studies and, you know, things that are proven that there are certain sounds or certain pieces or certain songs that transport us back to another time. And I like to think that maybe those carols bring up fond memories, maybe from their childhood, maybe from a special time from with their family or friends. And I like to think that that moment, even if they're, you know, maybe they're not feeling the best in their current situation, that carol can bring some joy and some respite, and that's what we always strive for in our caroling events.
Kirsten, can you step back and give us a bit of a history lesson about caroling?
Well, I can give a brief one. It's not going to be very long. What I know a little bit about caroling is limited, but what I do know is that caroling dates back to feudal medieval times when people would go to houses asking for food and drink. They would be beggars, people usually who were, needing food and drink, and they go to people's houses asking for those items, and they also ask for wassail, which is sort of a spiced eggnog. That's what my research tells me. And from there, the tradition of caroling grew. Although we do know that Oliver Cromwell, when he was in charge in England, he did ban caroling. And caroling has kind of evolved over the years and gone from being something that peasants did to gain some means of comfort and food and drink to becoming a way for people to gather, to becoming large performance events. And it's really grown and expanded over the years.
And your group perform at holiday events, you perform in front of a range of different audiences. What is your favorite song to perform as the Wisconsin Dickens carolers?
You know, that's always a hard question to ask. We get asked that a lot. And I think it really depends on the group. I could say today I'm really loving White Christmas.
What is it about White Christmas that's special to you?
I just think it's a really, you know, White Christmas came out of a time when the United States was coming off of a great war. And we were, you know, coming into this new era. And there's something about every time you hear that opening White Christmas song in the movie that just kind of gives you chills.
The White Christmas, just like the ones I used to know, where the treetops glisten and children listen to hear sleigh bells in the snow.
But there's something really beautiful about those lines, especially at the end of the carol, where people are, you know, hopeful. You know, may your days be bright. So even if things aren't great for you right now, there's hope that the future is going to be brighter. And I think that's what we all hope for at Christmas. We all hope that the new year is going to bring something beautiful, is going to bring something new and joyous. And I think that's something that we wish for during this holiday season, more so than even during the rest of the year.
We are talking with the Wisconsin Dickens carolers. They're a caroling troupe traveling the state. Kirsten Robley is a core member and artistic director. Kirsten, you have, you know, a style of costumes, Dickensian. What do these costumes look like?
So the very simple way of describing it is we look like we stepped out of Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol, which is the very simple way to describe it. But the women traditionally wear capes or dresses with skirts. Sometimes some of them have hoop skirts, some of them don't, just based on the cut and style of the skirt. Our male carolers generally wear suit jackets and sweaters or vests and ties. Some wear pea coats, and the men generally wear top hats. The women generally wear bonnets. And we accessorize with muffs and scarves, and we look something like out of Dickensian England by the time we get out to our performances.
I had that style in my mind, and I was curious whether the costumes are at all confining when you're trying to sing these carols and really be together in harmony.
No. So the costumes are built with the idea that we, you know, singers need rib expansion. We need to breathe.
Yeah.
They're also built with the idea that sometimes we might share costumes over the years with different carolers who are different body types and different heights. So we buy costumes and we invest in pieces that in theory could go between a few different body types of carolers, which often means that we use elastic for some of the waistbands on the skirts. And if carolers do decide to make the step and invest in their own custom costume piece, which a few have, they will purchase one that fits their body type, allowing for the proper room to breathe and to hit all those high notes and low notes that we need to do over a course of a caroling event.
What does it feel like to wear these costumes? And I wonder, does it transport you to a bygone era? Does it transport you to a Dickens novel?
I think there are moments when it does. I think it also depends on the event, but it definitely has that sort of like you're kind of outside of time. I mean, I know when I was in my costume this morning, I definitely don't feel like Kirsten of the current era in a pair of jeans and a sweater. But I do think it kind of takes you out of the current time. So I think there is a nostalgia or a sort of, I would agree with what you said, a time bygone that can exist when we're in the costumes. And I think that's part of the fun and the appeal of the Dickensian caroling, that it kind of takes you out of the current time. And I think our audience sees that as well.
Kirsten, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is wonderful.
Kirsten Robley is a member and artistic coordinator of the Wisconsin Dickens Carolers. We heard original music from the group performing Jingle Bells and White Christmas. Silent Night was sung by the Voices of Liberty. Here is more from the Wisconsin Dickens Carolers.
White Christmas, with every Christmas call.